Alright.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Nebraska is now open for the transaction of business. Draw nigh all ye having business with this Honorable Court, and ye shall be heard. God save the State of Nebraska and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. You may be seated. Good morning to everyone. We will begin with introductions from the court. I am Mike Havikin, the Chief Justice, and now by order of seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning, I'm Lindsay Miller-Lerman.
William Castle, good morning.
Stephanie Stacy, good morning.
Good morning, I am Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Papik, good morning.
And John Preidenberg.
Thank you, members of the court. Our first case this morning is In Re Adoption of Faith F. Ms. Lyne, good morning to you. And Ms. Melton, also good morning to you. Do either of you have any questions before we begin? Thank you, then, Ms. Lyne. You may approach and you may proceed.
Using 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Oh. May it please the court, Chief Justice, Your Honors, Counsel. My name is Lisa Lyne, and I'm here on behalf of Jerry and Stacy, Faith's maternal grandfather and his wife, who are present today. This is regarding an appeal of a county court order denying the adoption of Faith, their granddaughter, who has thrived in their care for almost 3.5 years, while at the same time determining that it was in her best interest to remain in their custody subject to a co-guardianship order. I'm not going to go into detail regarding any facts because this is an adoption matter, and I beg your indulgence of me using first names and initials as this is an adoption matter. Faith, a quick amount of context, Faith is the only child that was born of the marriage of Carrie and Zachary. Carrie is the daughter of the appellant Jerry and his ex-wife, the appellee Kelly. Faith was present in the family home when Carrie was murdered by Zachary, who took his own life. At the time of the deaths of her parents, Faith had just turned the age of 5. Faith had 2 teenage siblings. Carrie had 2 other children from prior relationships, 18-year-old J.R., who was raised and living with his father, and 12-and-a-half-year-old G.A., who is in Carrie's custody at the time of death and whose father resides outside of the state of Nebraska. J.R. is now an adult. G.A. is almost 16 and remains in appellee's care. Faith is now 8 years old. She considers Jerry and Stacy her parents and their house her home. The primary focus of my appeal, and I'm going to focus on the legal issues, is the standing of appellee and the interpretation of statutory best interests. Our position is that the appellee Kelly did not have standing. Her interest has always been in relation to visitation and contact. Appellee, while she does have, there's no question she has an emotional stake in this case. She doesn't have a legal or equitable personal right.
And what was the basis upon which the trial court found that she did have standing?
The basis the trial court found she did have standing ultimately was as a result of a co-guardianship order that had been entered separately. And our position is that In Re Guardianship of Sane indicates that when you have co-guardians, or if you have even a single guardian that has a personal emotional interest in a case to the outcome of the case, it requires the appointment of an independent guardian ad litem or an independent guardian. That was done in this case. Julie Frank was appointed as that guardian that for the in rem case before Judge Hutton.
Did the court say that he was appointing that guardian for that purpose? In any of our record, do we have anything?
In the record, that was the request of In the record, we had requested it specifically regarding appointing of the guardian ad litem for the purposes of the best interest and consent because of In re Saint. We did present that, and at that hearing, the court did appoint. Now, his order was identified best interest determination and consent. So,
now, but the order that you're saying did that was also the exact same order where he found that the co-guardian, the appellees, had standing to participate, correct?
Correct.
You're not taking the position that the appellee is not an interested person, are you?
She's an interested person in relation to she's a grandparent of Faith, but the cases in Nebraska there's only one case that exists regarding extra family members, and her position, her presentation, her representation through the court was not as a guardian, was always as a grandparent. There was never an entry of appearance. Now, there's no question that she ultimately was appointed as a co-guardian.
Is the case to which you refer an adoption case?
Yes.
Which
In re Amaya. That's the only case that I found talking about extraneous family members. In that case, it was a child of the adoptive of the father that was adopting the grandchild of his wife. And in that case, his son attempted to intervene personally and on behalf of, as next friend of his father, as there was a question of capacity of the father.
Well, that may have been more about inheritance or things of that nature. Is that safe to assume, or do we know?
As far as that particular case, ultimately, that probably, because obviously an adoption would result, it doesn't just result in the normal parental obligations to provide for medical needs and other needs, but it also is for support and inheritance.
Is your standing argument that the appellee failed to seek to participate in her capacity as co-guardian? Is that the objection? If appellee had said, I object as co-guardian, would your argument go away?
It doesn't go, I don't believe it goes away because she still is considered a self-interested person, and she herself and the guardian is a representational individual on behalf of the child as opposed to on behalf of herself, because there is no personal right to being a guardian, excepting only the constitutionally protected right of a natural parent to be guardian of their children.
So just if we were to throw in with you, would this create the situation of a potential race to the courthouse to adopt? In other words, the other party, the other person mm-hmm. that we're talking about would have an incentive to seek adoption, to foreclose your client from adopting? Is that what would result?
I don't believe so.
Why not?
Well, in this particular case, it is our position that the child has been residing with our clients, in the care of our clients, for almost 3.5 years. In the case of an adoption, there has to be a residence. There is a residency requirement of at least 6 months prior to the entrance of the order, and so it's not just anyone that can run to the courthouse to file an adoption. It needs to be somebody who actually has possession and care of the child.
So the incentive, as I understand you to be suggesting that we structure it, is that someone who's in the position that the appellee is should be striving to change the custody and not let more than 6 months go by in the hands of the other person.
Perhaps, but at the same time, you could have a cross adoption, which in this case was not filed, even though it was actually argued at one of the hearings that we had. That is part of the record. However, they did not move forward regarding the adoption.
Is your standing argument based on statute, case law, the Constitution? From where does it spring?
It springs, first of all, from statutes regarding parents are obviously the interested party regarding the rights of their children. There's no competing adoption petition in loco parentis, but in loco parentis statutory or case law is in loco parentis. Statutory is representing the state of Nebraska in parents patriae, and then there's the question of temporary co-guardians, and I feel that that was addressed case law-wise by In Re Sing.
Before you run out of time, would you like to move on to your second issue?
Just briefly, I'm going to just split regarding grandparent visitation and the goal being visitation and contact with extra family members. I'd focus on there are other Nebraska statutes. The adoption statutes only provide for visitation contact agreements between parents and biological children. Other Nebraska statutes emphasize the importance of permanency through adoption and not subordinating the right of the need for a child for permanency through adoption against the visitation interests of their sibling. There's the Foster Care Review Act, which is 43-1311.02, which talks about no subordination, that you're not supposed to subordinate that visitation interest that allows children, siblings, to intervene in juvenile court actions. There's 43-533, which talk about if there's no active parental involvement, then adoption should be aggressively pursued, and absent the possibility of adoption, other permanent settings should be pursued. And then the Foster Care Review Act also provides, and the 43-533 is regarding assistance for children, which is not part of the Foster Care Review Act. It's regarding sometimes developmental disability assistance or any assistance that might be received by the state. And then the Foster Care Review Act 43-1311.02 indicates that when there is a disparate dispositional goal and one sibling is to be adopted, they're supposed to provide training regarding the importance of sibling relationships, information regarding the siblings, and encouraging facilitation of post-adoption contact. There's no statute existing that states permanency through adoption should be subordinated to or denied to accommodate visitation needs of a sibling.
The standard review here is the trial court supposed to be upheld unless not supported by competent evidence or was arbitrarily, capriciously, or unreasonably entered. What is your best argument you have to overcome that standard?
My best argument to overcome that standard is obvious, is in my position, is regarding the law. I do feel that In Re, I apologize, Brett M. talks about the factors that should be focused on as opposed to custodial determinations, and those custodial determinations are regarding intact parental rights, and none of this identifies the need of the child who was completely ignored, the need, her need for stability and her need for support and inheritance. Those two things were never considered in this matter, and that is one of those are some of the largest things. It's not just money. She has been.
Did the judge put some kind of preference on keeping the siblings together?
Well, this is the difficult situation in this case. The older child has a biological father who is alive. And so he kept not keeping the siblings together, but keeping them in contact. I believe the entire order focuses on contact and visitation and ensuring that he can, I guess, control that going forward. But there was no evidence showing that my clients would have, at least I don't feel there was, that they were going to terminate visitation.
Is it relevant, the age of the siblings relevant?
I believe it is. You have a 7.5-year difference in age. One is in high school, one is in elementary school. That is a significant, there's a significant difference. And the older child in guardianship, adoption, and in dependency actions would have a say because she's over the age of 14.
Is it visitation with the sibling? Is it visitation with the maternal grandmother? What's the visitation issue, or is it both?
Regarding
the judge's decision.
The judge's decision. I believe it's primarily regarding the judge's decision focused on a negative. Did we provide enough evidence to show that there was going to be no disparate harm to a sibling relationship? There's never been any argument. Nobody in either party is arguing that the children don't have a sibling relationship and the grandparent doesn't have a grandparent's relationship. But a grandparent's right case could have been filed and preserved those rights, so there's no prejudice. There would be no prejudice for the other child. As long as, I guess, our issue is our clients would love to be able to see the older child. And in fact, he is her dentist, so he does see the older child. So this is a very unusual circumstance, but at the end of the day, the question is, what does faith need? And right now, an order that identifies custody with a hybrid guardianship order is very similar to what was done down in Florida, and I presented that case to the court where it was GS versus TB from Florida, where almost the exact same thing happened, where the lower court wanted to preserve the familial relationships globally and ordered a hybrid guardianship where both sets of grandparents were in control of the children. And the Supreme Court in Florida indicated that it's the antithesis of the right to permanency and stability for support of the children. With that, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ms. Melton, good morning to you.
Good morning. Mr. Chief Justice Hevekin and your honors, counsel, may it please the court, I am Amy Melton, and I represent the appellee, Kelly Bach. This is a case decided by the Honorable Judge Hutton in Sarpy County. We are asking this court to affirm the decision of the trial court, as he was present as the finder of fact, heard the testimony of witnesses, determined their credibility, and made a determination regarding the best interest of the child. The scope of review in adoption cases is a finding of error on the record. Judge Hutton's order sets out an analytic summary of the court's decision. This matter stems from a tragic set of facts that Ms. Lane went through. A little girl had the tragic loss of both parents, but this then led to a multitude of cases filed. The two main issues that I would like to address are, did Kelly Bach, the maternal grandmother, have standing to intervene and object to the adoption, and whether Judge Hutton erred on the record in determining the adoption was not in the faith's best interest. I will start with the issue of standing. The procedural history of the other pending cases is highly relevant. The parents passed away September 28th of 2019. One single juvenile court case was filed for both Faith and her sister. Faith and her sister, although her sister has a different father, they still kept it under one case. This is important because that case continued to pend for many years. The wills of both parents were found upon the release of property by the United States Air Force after the investigation was complete, but they weren't released until December of 2019, so more than 2 months after the death of the parents. Kelly is named as the person whom both parents wished to be guardian of the children upon their death. Kelly then filed two probate cases in December and two guardianship cases in January of 2020, so just months after, as soon as the wills were discovered. These cases, the guardianship cases, were stayed, though, pending the juvenile court case matter being opened, and both children were wards of the court. A motion to change placement of the girls from Grandfather Jerry's house to Grandma Kelly's was filed by DHHS and the GAL in April of 2020. The grandparents then attended mediation and agreed upon, stipulated to, having Faith's sister G be placed with Kelly and Faith remain placed with Jerry with a set time-sharing schedule, much like a parenting plan in family law cases. Unbeknownst to anyone, though, Jerry filed the adoption matter on May 21st, 2020, prior to actually engaging in the mediation. Ms. Novak, the GAL, became aware of it in August of 2020. So nobody was aware of this adoption matter from the time it was filed in May until August of 2020. What's significant
the significance of that?
Sorry, Judge. The guardianship case was filed in January of 2020. So it was filed approximately 5 months My client filed for guardianship 5 months before the adoption was filed. I think in the cases that the appellant was referring to in Florida, one of the their decision was that the grandparent either one of the cases declined any kind of guardianship, and then the other one didn't file on time. I mean, you can't linger and let the adoption sit there open and then decide, oh, well, I'm going to go in and file for guardianship. Here, the guardianship was filed immediately. The adoption was filed 5 months later. We became aware of the adoption petition in August of 2020 and immediately filed an objection and intervened and filed an objection.
And on what basis of standing did you file that objection? Was it a guardian? Is it a grandmother? Interested party? What was the basis of that?
We filed, first of all, the parental preference based upon what we named in the wills of both parents. Stated that they wished upon their passing that my client be awarded the guardianship of the children. Second,
I don't know if that's a principle of law that parental preference can be imposed on a non-parent. Is that your suggestion?
Well, our suggestion would be that the wills did, it shows what the parents wished, and because the parents stated in their wills they wish for my client
I misunderstood. You weren't using parental preference as a term of art.
No, I apologize.
Okay, thank you.
You were referring
to that which they seek.
The preference under the probate code for appointments of guardians based upon the nomination in a will.
That is correct. And the problem is we weren't able to file anything because we didn't get the wills. The wills weren't released because, unfortunately, the property was considered a crime scene. The U.S. Air Force wouldn't release anything in the home until December of 2019, which was more than 60 days past the death of the parents. But I think that's important because we also then filed for guardianship of the children. And then when we found out there was an adoption, filed an objection to that based upon the fact there is a pending guardianship. I mean, there was an open pending guardianship case. Granted, it was stayed because of the juvenile court matter, but also the juvenile court had not made any decisions. The children were still wards of the court at that time.
So with all of this history, to return to the original question,
yes,
is it guardian, co-guardian, grandmother, interested person, or in what capacity or capacities were you seeking to intervene in the adoption?
Well, I believe she is definitely an interested party, and she is somebody that was seeking guardianship of the child. She already has placement of her sister and was seeking guardianship of both children.
And by the time the court ruled upon the standing issue, she was a co-guardian.
That is correct. By the time the hearing happened on the standing matter, there was already a two-day evidentiary hearing in the guardianship matter. And after 2 days of receiving evidence and hearing from witnesses, Judge Hutton deemed that it was in the best interest of the child that there be a co-guardianship in place.
I want to turn you to the language of the statutes for the adoption statutes. Section 43-533 sub 5 and 43-109 both have as key parts of those determinations best interest of the child.
That is
what factors should be considered, and where can we find those?
Well, I think that the factors that should be considered, first, I think the best interest of the child is paramount in all cases.
I prefer you tell me the factors that you found from someplace else first before you tell me what we should consider, what you think we should consider.
Well, I believe that the best interest of the children, some of the factors that should be considered, can be found in family law cases. And in the case of In re Brett M., which was a case where it's distinguishable from this one, they were talking about placement and adoption from an agency. So even in Brett M., what the court said, it provides for a list of factors that the court should consider, but the court states these are not the only factors and should be not limited to those. And I think they were referring to when it's placement, not in a case like this where you have two divorced grandparents who both have involvement with the child, loving relationships with the child. In this particular case, I think that the family law best interest of the child should be looked at. And I think that the Supreme Court in this case states that the factors in custody cases are, although relevant, recognizing that those are relevant in adoption cases, are not the most appropriate criteria to determine the best interest in the current context. So they were referring to, in Brett N., the current context of that case, which is completely distinguishable from our case.
So to respond further, I take it from your response that you're drawing upon the statutory definition of best interests in the Parenting Act.
Well, I think that what the statute provides is that the trial court has the ultimate discretion to determine the best interest of the child.
The statute being?
The adoption statutes, when they list out the factors of what you have to prove, and even in Brett M., what's paramount, it says, and that it be in the best interest of the child.
Well, but that statute doesn't specify what factors are considered in best interest, does it?
It does not. I think it leaves it up to the discretion of the trial court to identify what the best interests of the child are in the particular facts of that case. And I believe that that's the case in even in family law cases where you're dealing with best interest of the child. There could be so many different factors that could be considered for the best interest of the child that they leave it to the trial court.
Do you or don't you think that the best interest definition of the Parenting Act statute has any application?
I do, and I think that the Supreme Court recognized that it is relevant in the In re Brett M case that in 2008. They recognized that although relevant, they don't necessarily apply to that particular case. So I think that the Supreme Court has recognized those are relevant factors in determining the best interest of the child.
Just not an exhaustive list.
Correct, and they even say, but not limited to, when they're providing the factors in the In re Brett M case. I think when you're talking about best interest of the child, you can't argue that when you have divorced parents that somehow the best interest of the child is completely different than maybe in this case, where you're saying that taking a child away from their extended family, not having contact with potentially their siblings, their grandparents, their aunts, and their uncles, which could be extremely traumatic. And the testimony at trial in this adoption matter was that both grandparents were extremely involved in their child's life, and that change to this child would be traumatic. This child has already encountered a traumatic event by losing her parents. This would be the second most traumatic thing if you completely change the dynamics of this child's life, where she is no longer the sibling to her brother or sister. Kelly would no longer be her grandparent. Kelly would not be able to file a grandparent's rights case in this matter because then she actually wouldn't have standing. She would no longer be the grandparent pursuant to the grandparent statute in grandparent cases. That would keep her from having standing to even get grandparent visitation rights. So in this case, I don't believe that Judge Hutton erred on the record.
One more question regarding the statute. Section 43-533 sub 5 states that adoption is to be aggressively pursued when families can't be reunited. There's a new sentence that says, absent the possibility of adoption, other permanent settings shall be pursued. How do we deal with those two phrases that seem to go against the position you have here, that adoption is to be aggressively pursued, and the absence of the possibility of adoptions when you look at other alternatives?
Well, I think in the absence of adoptions, I think that's what Judge Hutton was saying. He does not believe that it is in the best interest of the child for adoption, and that actually recognizes that there are other permanent objectives that can be put in place, such as a permanent guardianship.
So the best interest analysis is what makes this possibility of adoption impossible.
Right, correct. And that is one of the factors that, in my opinion, is paramount to the finding in an adoption case is that it is in the best interest of the child. And there are other permanent objectives that are available, which is exactly what was done in this case. Right now, it's a temporary guardianship because it stayed because of this case. Judge Hutton now can hear the permanent guardianship and put a permanent guardianship in place.
So is your argument then that adoption is just not possible under this set of facts, as the statute anticipates?
That it's not possible because it's not in the best interest of the child, which is, pursuant to the statute, one of the paramount things that the judge has to determine in an adoption case. So that would make any one of the factors to be equally... could be equally weighed, this one,
and that,
the factor,
and that this
factor.
Outcome is the best that can happen under this set of facts.
Correct.
While respecting the statutory requirement. Is that your view?
That is my view. And under the scope of review for adoptions, I don't believe that Judge Hutton erred on the record, and he did not abuse his discretion in finding that The adoption was not in the best interest of the child. And in fact, I think a co-guardianship could actually secure and be more permanent and provide more security to Faith moving forward in the future, because it gives Judge Hutton the ability to make further determinations moving forward in the future, just like any other district court judge in a family law case.
Does the court's order bar any future petitions for adoption?
It does not.
So if situations were to change,
correct,
someone could come back and file a petition for adoption under the new set of facts.
That is correct. Hypothetically, if Judge Hutton found in the future under the guardianship that the co-guardianship didn't work, that maybe one party should have guardianship over the other, I mean, absolutely Judge Hutton could then consider moving forward with an adoption.
And the judge in this case indicated that adoption wasn't the best outcome at this time? Was it time sensitive?
I don't believe that Judge Hutton used that language in his order, but it doesn't preclude him from doing it in the future.
The order just sustained the objection to the adoption and set the guardianship matter for further proceedings.
That is correct, Judge Steve.
Thank you.
So I believe my time is up. Any further questions? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. Counts in in re adoption of Faith F. So you are excused. Thank you very much.